Long before modern man walked the Earth, our planet was home to a vast array of fascinating fauna, so bizarre, they defy the limits of human imagination. Over the past century, Western Colorado has emerged as a region rich in paleontological treasure. And through the work of dedicated local paleontologists, continues to play a vital role in advancing our understanding of the prehistoric world. In part two of Going Paleo, I chat with Stephanie Lukowski, curator of education for Museums of Western Colorado. Stephanie reflects on the struggles of scientific study, sometimes faced by people of faith, the freakish world of prehistoric mammals, and her mission to mainstream scientific knowledge. Welcome to Season 3 of the official podcast of Crossing the Divide, a multimedia exploration of life in the Intermountain West. Crossing the Divide counters a media culture fixated on urbanism and elevates a region defined by open space, sweeping vistas, big skies, and natural wonder. I'm Gretchen Reist, guiding you over the divide and into the diverse terrain of the American West. Well, Stephanie, welcome to Crossing the Divide. And I wanted to start off, if you could, by tracing your career path from its beginning to what brought you to your current position as curator of education for the Museums of Western Colorado.
Oh, gosh, that's a really, really long story, but I'll try to keep it somewhat short. I grew up in Chicago, where I was really fascinated by fossils as a kid. Meaning my family, would go to the Field Museum quite often, something I knew that I wanted to do from the beginning. So I went to Tulane in New Orleans, and I got a bachelor's degree in geology. After there, I went to South Dakota School of Mines and Technology and got a master's degree in vertebrate paleontology. And just a week ago, I finished up a master's in natural science education, and I'm done with school for good, I hope. We'll see. You never know. But after my paleontology master's degree in 2004, I started working at a small museum in Hot Springs, South Dakota, called the Mammoth Site of Hot Springs, South Dakota. It's a giant sinkhole that trapped tons of Columbian and woolly mammoths there. And they built the building around the sinkhole, and that was a really neat experience. From there, I spent some time doing paleontology consulting. So I would be the person who would go out into the field, whether it be before they built oil and gas wells, roads, houses, you name it, solar panels, all of that kind of thing. And I'd make sure there were no fossils in the way. I'd remove them and take them to a local museum or other repository. Or I'd hike the area prior to construction to let them know what could potentially impact their construction. From there, I got to be a part of the Panama Canal Project, which is with the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute and the University of Florida, where I got to live in Panama for 4.5 months and salvage fossils along the canal while they were expanding it and deepening it. And now that area is underwater, so it was a pretty cool experience to rescue as many fossils as we possibly could. I also most recently was the paleontologist for the Ice Age Discovery Center in Snowmass Village, Colorado, where I got to design programs and educate the public about the fantastic find up there. And then just last September, I moved to Grand Junction to be the curator of education for the Museums of Western Colorado. So I'm not just doing paleontology at the moment. I am doing history and archaeology, but paleontology is my passion and my background.
So were you one of those kids who started learning about dinosaurs and paleontology? And were you the kid who had all the books and memorized every single name of every type of dinosaur? Because it seems like a lot of kids go through that phase of just being completely enamored and fascinated by this topic.
Oh, yeah. I was definitely that kid. I was such a nerdy kid. I just loved fossils and loved science and that sort of thing. But not every paleontologist goes through that phase. So it's important to realize that if any of your listeners want to become a paleontologist, they don't have to always have that as a passion from the beginning. They can come at it later. But there are a lot of us who just kind of latched on early and just stuck with it as well.
What characteristics beyond just the curiosity of the field do you think people should have who seriously consider pursuing
this as a career?
Well, I think paleontology, like any science, to be successful, you need to be able to be open-minded, because science isn't this static thing. It's not just learn everything in a textbook and then you know it, you have science, you understand it. The more data we get, the more finds we have, the more it changes our mind about what may have happened. So it can either confirm things we know or can completely upend them. So being open-minded, being willing to put in hard work, because paleontology is hard work, whether you're in the field or in the lab or writing papers, you need to be able to be dedicated, work hard, and open-minded towards new discoveries and new possibilities. And creative, I would say, because you have to be creative to come up with questions about past ecosystems that we may never have seen at all. So there's a lot of creativity involved as well.
So you were a kid who was obviously very passionate about science. This is a little bit off topic, but it does seem that we struggle with science education in this country a little bit. Tell me about your own personal experience. Did you feel that as a kid who was going to pursue a scientific field, did you feel that your basic education in those early years was adequate? Do you feel that it was stimulating enough to young minds who had that kind of a passion?
Oh boy, so this is this is an interesting question for me, because I didn't have the typical educational experience as a child. I went to a Lutheran school from kindergarten through eighth grade, where I was taught creationism and science class. And then I went to a Catholic high school where I did get exposed to evolution. So it was kind of two different sides of the same coin. If you're wondering how that happened, my mom is Lutheran and my dad is Catholic. So I got a little bit of both. So I can't necessarily speak to how it was when I was first going to school for the general public, because I don't think that was a typical experience. I definitely was a little bit of a rebel. So when I was told that I shouldn't study evolution because it would send me to hell, I did anyways. And then I learned that there are other faiths that don't view that as incompatible and that it's okay. So, but that was definitely a struggle. And I know there are some other people who have that kind of struggle. But today, with my master's in natural science education and my work as a curator of education, one of the things I'm trying to do is build educational programming that is based on student-led inquiry. So not just transmission of facts and just this is how it is, because that's not how science is. As I said before, like, science is changing, and science is asking questions and maybe never finding the answers, or maybe finding more questions, that sort of thing. So I like to give students, regardless of whether they're just starting out or you know, finishing up high school, that kind of experience to ask questions, to come to their own conclusions by thinking critically and analyzing the data. So there's definitely a switch to making science education more dynamic, and I hope to see a lot more of that.
This is a really personal question, and you don't have to answer it if you don't feel comfortable. But as somebody who did grow up in a faithful family, going into the sciences then, did it make you question your faith anymore, or did it strengthen it?
Well, I will say this. So I'm the first generation college grad in my family, which is another kind of interesting thing. My dad is now a retired welder. My mom's a nurse, but she went to nursing school when it was more like a trade school before you got your bachelor's degree in college to do that. And it was very important for my parents that myself and my siblings went to college. So they did think that we would get a better education through the religious schools than the local public school on the south side of Chicago. So to that end, it succeeded. But it did definitely, you know, going to an evangelical Lutheran church and school, it definitely did cause some conflicts in my personal way of thinking. But like I said, when I went to Catholic high school, there was an acceptance of scientific thought. So it taught me that being a Christian didn't mean that you have to reject science. And I think there are a lot of scientists who have gone through similar struggles.
I've heard from many scientists when asked of that question, are science and faith mutually exclusive things? A lot of scientists will tell you that to them, it's the search for God, that in their view, what they're trying to do is searching for God.
I think the nature of science and the nature of religion are two different things. So science can't answer supernatural questions. It's just not designed that way. So science isn't really built to prove or disprove the existence of a God. That's the realm of religion and the spiritual, and that they're separate, but they're both important things for people to have in their lives. So science is just a method of inquiry, a method of asking questions about the natural world and trying to find answers with as little bias as possible. Because we're human beings, there's always going to be bias involved. You know, we're imperfect beings employing the system. So there's definitely, you know, it's not the most perfect system, but it's the best system we have to answer questions about the natural world. So to that end, I don't think it's incompatible, but I wouldn't necessarily say that it would be a good method for finding God, because just the tools that science has in its toolbox aren't meant for those kind of questions. But if people see it that way, I don't see anything wrong with that either. You know, for however many scientists there are in the world, there's that many different views on what science is and isn't.
Let's go to the Ice Age Discovery Center. That was a big part of your work, and because this was a discovery that was made right in Snowmass, I was wondering if we could delve into the details of those findings. Can you speak to the history of that find and the importance of it?
Oh, yeah. So this was a really, really major find for Ice Age paleontology in the world, really, not just the state of Colorado. So the town of Snowmass had done a study. They were looking to see if they had enough water resources in the event of a forest fire, and they determined they did not. So they wanted to build a reservoir to act as a storage for water. So in 2018, after they had selected the land, went through all that process that you need to do, they began digging, and it didn't take very long. So in October of 2010, they uncovered the first bones, and then they did a little bit of digging, took a winter hiatus, and then had just a few months in the spring to get as much as they could out before the reservoir needed to be completed. And in that period of time, they found 36,000 bones, tusks, and teeth from 52 species of Ice Age animal, all sorts of fossil plants, fossil insects, and other little invertebrates. So it was a very major find that gives us a window into how the climate changed at high elevation between 145,000 years ago and about 40,000 years ago.
When we were first coordinating this podcast, you had made a mention that your specialty is in fossilization of mammals. Can you talk to the importance of that distinction within paleontology and why it's important that those specialties exist?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's something that not a lot of people realize. So not every fossil is a dinosaur, but all the things we think of dinosaurs can be a fossil. Dinosaurs are still alive today, by the way, in the form of birds. So that's why I was kind of hedging my language there a little bit. But all sorts of different types of animals and plants can become a fossil. So there are paleontologists who specialize in fossil fish, other reptiles, amphibians, birds, and dinosaurs, you know, that predate birds, as well as mammals. And so mammals are like you and I. They're warm-blooded. They have fur. Some of them lay eggs. Some of them give birth to live young. So they get a little weird when you go further back in time. But fossil mammals are what I study. And I think that's kind of interesting. Most people, though, really like to go for the dinos.
What made you choose mammals?
It was actually a little bit more of a practical concern. So when I was in grad school, the National Science Foundation was funding a project, and I was a small part of that, and I got offered the chance to look at these weird mammals that appeared after the dinosaurs died, called phenacodonids, which no one's heard of them. They're bizarre. And they're just kind of very common, so no one thinks about them too terribly much during the time period they lived, but I jumped on the opportunity because it was funding. And as I started to study them, I fell in love with them. And I've made it this far in my career without having to go work on dinosaurs until I joined Museums of Western Colorado and Dinosaur Journey. So I've covered mammals from right after the dinosaurs died all the way through mammals, Ice Age mammals, so when humans first appeared. But not humans themselves, I should also add. So that's a little different.
When you decided to specialize in mammals, was there a part of you that mourned the chance to really delve into the dinos, or were you just really taken by this idea of specializing in mammals?
I think dinosaurs are the first exposure people have to paleontology, and they're neat. Some of them are gigantic, not all of them, but the ones that really capture people's imagination are huge and scary and just bizarre and hard to picture almost in a way. But the more you learn about the Earth's history, there are bizarre forms in all sorts of different animal groups, and mammals are no different. So I wouldn't say that I mourned the chance to study dinosaurs, more as I was really excited to take a peek into this world that ended up coming to be after the dinosaurs died. So in essence, you have these giant lizards, if you will, occupying all the different parts of the ecosystem, and then they're wiped out except for the smaller birds. And then mammals get their chance, and they're bizarre. You know, first, while the dinosaurs were alive, most of them kind of looked like rats, and it didn't matter what they eventually evolved into being. They were just these rat-like things. And now they get to get bigger and eat different things and interact with their ecosystem in different ways. And that, I think, is really, really cool. And I'm a sucker for the underdog. So the less studied and the more bizarre it is, the more I'm interested in it.
So give us some examples of mammals that you study.
Well, like I mentioned, in grad school, I studied phenacodonids. So these were five-toed, kind of medium dog-sized, low-toothed mammals that we think became persodactyls. So things like horses or tapirs way later on. But at this point in time, they're just bizarre looking. And we still don't know exactly how they relate to modern animals or if they do at all. So that's just kind of the prevailing thought. And so those are really, really neat, and they still have my heart, even though no one's heard of them, and some paleontologists look at me funny when I mention it. But in my more recent time, I've worked on a lot of Ice Age animals, so things like mammoths and mastodons, and I have a passion for giant sloths. So in Snowmass, we found the first ever skull of a Jefferson's ground sloth, and that was just a medium-sized sloth from the Ice Age, and it was 10 foot tall, so the size of the mastodons roaming around. But in South America, some of them could be 23 feet tall, so the size of a full-size school bus. And so totally different from the sloths we have today, and they're kind of neat to think about. And who doesn't love sloths?
Well, it was interesting that you mentioned that, because that was one of the biggest things I recalled from visiting the Ice Age Discovery Center, was the fact that a sloth had been found. And I don't think I was aware that there were sloths in these parts at any point in time.
Oh, yeah. So sloths originated in South America. And when the Isthmus of Panama closed, which was one of the things we were looking at when I was doing fieldwork in Panama, so way back when, that allowed animals from North America to head south and from South America to head north. So all the giant sloths that were living throughout South America, well, I shouldn't say all of them, but some species were able to move north and survive. And the Jefferson's ground sloth that we found in Snowmass, that same species was found as far north as Alaska. So it lived in a range of environments. So they're pretty neat animals.
What is it about sloths that you like so much?
Just the bizarreness. So, it's just really hard to picture a 10-foot tall sloth roaming around, walking on the outer edges of its feet, and eating things like avocados. If you like avocados, you should thank a sloth, a giant sloth, because they could swallow those pits and spread the seeds around. We wouldn't have them without that. So if you're like me and like avocados, Sloths should hold an extra special place in your heart.
I do love avocados, and I will think of that every time I eat one now. Thank you for that information. I had no idea.
People usually get excited when they learn that, so that's one of my favorite factoids to share.
So we know that the mastodons were a big part of the find in the snowmass area, and it got me to thinking, and of course this goes back to the Jurassic Park idea of taking that DNA and you know, recreating some of these creatures that once existed. And it's either the mastodon or the woolly mammoth that always comes up for that. And I've read some articles fairly recently where maybe there's some momentum gaining on this idea of bringing back a woolly mammoth. So as a scientist, first, I want to ask how you feel about the ethics of doing something like that. And then two, bringing back a creature that was so prominent during the Ice Age into a time when our climate is warming, how much does that make sense?
Well, one of the things we learned from snowmass is how organisms, animals at high elevation react to climate change, because that was really the big message from there. We had this great time slice, almost 100,000 years, that showed us what happened up there, because the temperature did oscillate as the glaciers advanced and receded. So people think of the Ice Age as being this one time where there are massive sheets of ice, but actually the ice came down, it retreated back, it came down, it did this several times throughout there. So we get this snapshot. And when it was warmer, there were mastodons. They actually found 36 mastodons, so snowmass is the largest site in the world for that animal. And when it got colder, that's when we found just a few Columbian mammoths, which are the larger cousin to the woolly mammoth. There's actually several types of mammoths. Columbians are the biggest. Woolies are a little bit smaller, but they live in different habitats. So Columbian mammoths like a little bit warmer. Woolly mammoths with their shaggy coats like it where it's a lot colder. So you don't usually find them in the same place. But it was a massive loss of diversity when it became colder compared to the warmth. So we know that changes in the temperature are going to change the type of animals that can live at high elevation. It's going to change the ranges of animals in general, and just change the ranges of plants that the animals eat. So it's good. It could potentially really disrupt ecosystems, both high elevation and low. The animal they usually talk about cloning is the woolly mammoth. And the woolly mammoth is most closely related to the Asian elephant today. But they're still different genus and species, so they're pretty, pretty far removed from each other. And every time I read, they say, oh, we're just 5 years out. And that's been going on for a while. Do I think they'll eventually come up with the technology to make something that looks like a woolly mammoth? Yes, I think they probably will eventually, but it's a very difficult process. So first of all, DNA does not last very long. It starts to break down after an animal dies. And so we do not have a complete strand of woolly mammoth DNA. So there's often talk about having to insert it into Asian elephant DNA. And at that point, you don't have a woolly mammoth, you have a hybrid. But because it's a different genus and species, meaning they're far enough removed that they don't even share. So, you know, you have your species like us, we're Homo sapiens. Sapiens is our species. Homo is our genus. And then a genus is a collection of species that are more closely related to each other than they are to other ones, other species. So that makes a genus. Well, yeah, once again, the woolly mammoth is separate even by another order from there. So there's a lot of difference to overcome. And in animals today, if two different organisms somehow come into contact and mate and their DNA is different enough, usually that gets rejected from the body. So there's going to be a lot that they have to overcome to produce a viable embryo. The offspring may or may not be mammoth-like. And then also there's a lot of questions we won't be able to answer because elephants, proboscideans, that's the family, that's elephants and their extinct relatives, are social creatures. So they learn how to behave. Like an elephant learns how to be an elephant from other elephants. And we think it was the same way with mammoths. So it might not even end up acting like a mammoth. So And to your point, the ecosystems are changing. So you introduce this poor, lonely animal into a changing landscape, and they went extinct on their own because of climate change. So I don't think they would fare necessarily as well. And I don't think it's a good use of our resources, to be honest. If we wanted to resurrect a species, I would much rather see a species that went extinct because of human interference more recently in the Earth's history, as opposed to one that went extinct from natural causes around 4,000 years ago.
So you were at the Ice Age Discovery Center in Snowmass, and you came to this area. So was there something in particular about the Grand Junction area that attracted you to this region, outside of even just that there was a job opportunity? Was there anything specific about the role that this area plays in paleontology that was enticing to you?
Oh, I love this area. I'm so happy that I moved here. In fact, I was telling some of my coworkers today that the only thing I miss about Snowmass, and Snowmass is a great place, so if anyone is listening from there, I didn't dislike my time there at all, but I like being cold. So the heat was the only negative, but there's so many more positive aspects to living here. One, when I'm going hiking, I can actually see the rocks. They're not covered in trees. And trees are beautiful. They give us oxygen. I love trees. But if you're looking for fossils, having the desert landscape is far more appealing for that. And I just happen to love the desert so, so much. And yeah, this area has so many paleontologists. So I was a little isolated entity up in Snowmass. And down here, there are so many great paleontologists and geologists that I can interact with, bounce ideas off of, and just collaborate with, which is really essential in science. You know, we're not, you know, oftentimes you get that visual image of like one scientist in their lab coat making a discovery, and that's not how it goes. We work together, and we, as I was saying before, we each have our different specialties. So if I have a dinosaur question, I would call a dinosaur paleontologist, whereas if they had a question about Ice Age animals or Nacodonids, maybe they'd call me or another expert in those areas. So it's nice to have opportunities to interact with other scientists, and just the collections of Dinosaur Journey are vast. And there are some mammals there. I'm hoping we'll get more, but it's just really neat to learn about animals that are vastly different than what I studied, and just be in an area where there are people who are making these discoveries and doing good science.
So you came here to be a curator of education and then worked toward another postgraduate degree in natural science education. What was it that made you want to pursue education as opposed to going heavy into field work?
Well, I was a field paleontologist for 10 years, and that was a lot of fun, and I really loved it. But as I would interact with construction workers, or when I was in Panama, just the general public, I realized there was a lot of people who are very curious about paleontology but may not have access to that scientific knowledge. And as a first-generation college graduate in general, I realized how important access is to those type of things. So I still do some research. I still do some publications and things of that nature, but I think it's very important to make science accessible to everyone, because really that's who this knowledge is for. All of us, you know, have a stake in learning more about the world around us, how it was in the past, make predictions about how it might be in the future, and that sort of thing. So I want to give people the opportunities that I never had, or, you know, I want people to realize that scientists are regular people who have interests and hobbies and families and friends, and we don't just eat, breathe, and live science. There's other parts of us. So by going out in the community, it's my way of giving back and encouraging the next generation of scientists.
When I go out hiking, I'm looking at rocks, and I know nothing. I don't know what to look for. Occasionally, I will see something and think, I wonder if that could be something. But I would have no idea. What role do you feel that the general public plays in advancing the field of paleontology and increasing the body of knowledge that we have about those creatures that existed on Earth before us. And I bring this up because I recall a couple of years ago, right here in outside of Fruita, I think there was a young boy from back east somewhere who found something of great importance. It might have been something that had never been discovered before. And just yesterday, I saw an article about a young boy in Ohio who found what I think was a mastodon tusk or something. But he was just out hiking. We could be walking past these things all the time. Do you think it's important for the general public to know what to look for? Because if they're out riding bikes, hiking, camping, they could stumble across a really big find and not even know it.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm so glad you brought that up. So yeah, when you're in an area like this where there's vast potential resources, there's a good chance that you will walk by a fossil. And if that's the case, the best thing to do, if you see something that you think is a fossil, is take a picture of it and GPS where it's at, and then bring it in to, depending on the land you're at, it could be, you know, a BLM ranger, or bring it the picture to the museum, and we'll gladly take a look at it and let you know. There is a little bit of issues with picking up fossils from the land. You need to know who the landowner is, because it is illegal to take fossils from vertebrate animals, so things with bones, off of BLM, National Forest Service, any state or federal land. If it's in your own backyard, it's a little bit different. So if it's in your backyard, you own the fossils, technically. But once again, if you really want to get that scientific background about what that fossil is and that context, it's really important we have it in place, because that can give us the age, the environment it lived in. You might find a species that's really common in one time period, but then you find it in this other area where we've never found it before, and all of a sudden we know it lived much earlier or much later than we previously thought. Or you can find something completely new that we knew nothing about, and in which case knowing what layer it is to get all that information is very, very important. But absolutely, we paleontologists can't be everywhere all the time. We have other things to do, like teaching and caring for the fossils in our collection. We may have our set field area that we go to all the time and don't get a chance to branch out. So I think the general public can play a very important role in advancing science. And sometimes if you find a new species, they'll name it after you. So there's a little extra fun incentive to let the paleontologist know about what you find. And if you don't find something, that's okay too. We still like to know what's out there. So, you know, just that curiosity and wonder is what's really important.
Do you think about that, though, as you're doing, I don't know if you're leading any of these field expeditions, but I know that you can go. I know the museum offers them. Do you think about that at all in terms of teaching people to know what to look for? Because then you have, you know, you could have this whole cadre of people who now know what to look for when they're out adventuring.
Oh, definitely. So recently, Rob Gay from the Colorado Canyons Association and I led a trip. We rafted down the Ruby Horse Thief section of the Colorado River, and we took people into some of the side canyons looking for potential fossil resources in these canyons that hadn't been explored before. And so, yeah, we found a little bit, nothing super exciting or, you know, but we found a few areas that are worth going back and checking in the future. And part of that was because of our volunteers. So, or I shouldn't say our volunteers, our
participant.
Our participant, thank you. And so that was because of our participants. They, you know, were able to have an eye on the ground, and they were able to learn what to look for. And to be honest, learning what to look for is not the hardest part about paleontology. So anyone can do it. It just takes some time and a trained eye. So it's very worth coming to one of our digs, going out with us, and we can show you what to look for. The skill really comes in identifying what you have, and that's why you have the professionals. But finding a fossil, that's not too hard, especially around here where they're all over the place.
In just looking up information on you, just in my research to know what kinds of questions to ask, it just so happens that I have the All Trails app, and I typed in your name, and you came up, and the All Trails, or you're kind of logging what you do. When you are out hiking and doing these things, do you ever get this feeling or this sense of, I wonder what is right under my, what could be right under my feet, that there's got to be treasure troves of stuff that we likely will never even find? Does that ever bother you, or does it fascinate you, or do you even think about it at all?
Oh, I think about it all the time, and I find it fascinating. It's just getting my geology degree kind of in a way made the world, I feel like almost, this is not the right word, but it almost made the world feel a little more magical. And obviously science is not magic, but it made the past really come alive. So I can look at different rock units and think, oh gosh, you know, when this rock was being laid down, this area was a giant dune field and there were sand dunes as far as the eye could see, or this was an incredible river system. So it really gave me that sense of time and place that's unique to understanding deep time. And I think about what's under my feet all the time. In fact, if you were to come out hiking with me, you'd notice that I tend to look at the ground a lot, and that's just habit from being a field paleontologist for over a decade. Just that's where you find the fossils, is at the surface. So I'm not the fastest hiker when I hike because I'm looking at the ground, but then I always have to stop and remind myself to look around because there are plenty of beautiful things besides the rocks. But yeah, there's plenty of things that may have eroded out of rocks, you know, 3 million years ago before humans were here in North America, and, you know, we'll never know about those either. But if we're lucky, you know, we'll find the right, you know, we'll be at the right place at the right time.
In your work in science education, you have touched and will continue to touch a lot of people with your knowledge. What is the most important takeaway that you hope you impart on those people who have participated and will be participating in the museum's educational programs? Aside from knowing what to look for in a fossil, what do you hope is a big takeaway for them?
You know, I really hope that everyone takes away that science is for everyone, and that there is no one way to be a good scientist. We all have different skills, and they're all needed, and different perspectives are needed. So there's no one type of person that's best suited to that. And I want everyone to feel that even if they don't want to become a scientist in their career, they can still have a role and be citizen scientists or just science appreciators. It's for everyone.
Well, Stephanie, I'm sure that I speak for everybody listening that we're very grateful to have you here. It's wonderful to have that talent and that knowledge base here in our community, helping to educate not just our residents, but everyone who travels here from faraway places to learn more about this field. So we're glad to have you here, and I'm thrilled that you were able to come in and talk to me about your personal history with science and your work. So thank you.
Thank you for having me, and I hope your listeners can come and see us at the museum sometime.
That ends another edition of Crossing the Divide. Thanks for tuning in. Access our full lineup of conversations with Western Voices by searching Crossing the Divide on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and Spotify. Hit subscribe to stay plugged in to each new episode. Follow Crossing the Divide on Facebook and Instagram to keep up on podcast releases and access exclusive video and photography. Support for Crossing the Divide's official podcast comes from Rocky Mountain PBS, Mesa County Libraries, and the Daily Sentinel. Crossing the Divide, a voice for the Intermountain West.